My name is Jim, and I am a recovering alcoholic. I love to say that, recovering, because it makes me look at my whole life down those long vistas of time and see all that I had and lost. And to realize from the vantage point of tonight some of the things I never had. And to be able to say to you tonight, I am recovering a lot of things I lost and a lot of things I never had. I am recovering principally a spirituality. A spirituality of life and a spirituality of living that is directly and primarily and essentially related to those 12 steps, without which nothing. I'm recovering a spirituality I never had in my whole life. Religion, yes. Up to my ears. But never spirituality. And in that wonderful exposure to the 12 steps, I recovered for the first time in my life, despite all the religion, I recovered God. I recovered my greater power. Or as I now prefer to say, having read chapter 4 so many times, I have recovered my great reality. What a wonderful way to refer to it, to that power. Never hear that in AA meetings. Never hear anyone refer to that element in their life as the great reality, and yet it occurs in chapter 4, chapter to the agnostic, and it's capitalized in this beautiful sentence. We finally found the great reality that we're all looking for. What's real? What's real? Got to get at what's real. And we look and look and look and look, and I looked and looked and looked and looked for what's real. When I finally found the great reality, can you imagine where I found it? Quoting chapter 4, deep within myself, which in the last of analysis is the only place it can be found. The great reality, capital G, capital R. That was something I never had in my whole life. I am more real standing here tonight than I've ever been in my whole life. Because I've had a contact with great reality. And due to those 12 steps, besides recovering spirituality, besides recovering a greater power, who might prefer to call God, I have recovered my Catholic faith. And in recovering that Catholic faith, I have recovered my priesthood. And I have recovered a host of friends that I never had before, who accept me as I am, with no ands, ifs, buts, or anything. And I have recovered, through these 12 steps and through the whole program, I have recovered something I never had before. Not one sponsor, but three. And I would not be standing here tonight were it not for those 12 steps and those three sponsors. My first exposure to alcohol was in the fourth grade. I am the product of a total Catholic education from kindergarten to fourth year college. And in the old time Catholic schools, and I was raised in a school, Irish school really, totally Irish. Do you know that I never knew a non-Irish person until I went to high school? That tends to make a blockhead out of you. Do you know I never knew a non-Catholic until I went to college? Amazing. So narrow-minded. That's a marvelous thing about the 12 steps. You cannot live the 12 steps and stay prejudiced very long. You cannot live the AA program and stay prejudiced very long. Your horizons got to widen if you're going to accept everybody and anybody. I was trained in a good Catholic school where in the fourth grade, if you were a very good student, you would be chosen to be a server, a mass server. And I was an excellent student. And I was chosen. And this is the old time church, if there's anybody here of that rare vintage. When everything was in Latin, the priest had his back to the audience and everything. And you had to learn just a whole slew of Latin prayers. Didn't know what they meant. But after a while, I didn't feel so badly about that because I found out the priest didn't know what he was reading anyway. As long as you made some sounds and a few bows, people accepted it. But I'm a romantic by nature, and I was completely enraptured by the Mass and all the pomp, all the ritual and the ceremonial. So like many a Catholic youth, in my basement I set up an altar. We had an old-time Victrola, old electric Victrola. And I put a bed sheet over it, two candlesticks on it. I think I went out and got some dandelions, put two cups of dandelions on there, got my prayer book out. Went to the candy store and got a package of what we call Boston wafers. You may call them Necco wafers, little round candies. But they looked like the altar breads in the Catholic Church. And we had a lovely bar in our basement. So I went over and got a cocktail glass, which kind of looked like a chalice. And got it all there on the Victrola. And opened up the book and went through all this. Amen. And I was in seventh heaven. Until one day, like Edison, a light went on. And we had a lovely room to one side of the basement called a wine cellar. It was quite a large room. My mother had all kinds of shelves. And all these bottles, row upon row, all the way to the ceiling of the floor. Row upon row of wine bottles, all on their side. She said, resting. Wine has to rest. Well, needless to say, when I discovered wine, those poor bottles stopped resting. And I have to share with you that in the fourth grade, to show you how I've been an alcoholic from birth, really. In the fourth grade, I learned very quickly that you have to water the bottles to keep them looking like they're full. And in the Catholic Church, it's still kind of a law that a priest is not supposed to say more than one Mass a day unless the need of the people, the faithful, require it. Then he may say two or three, any number, but ordinarily one Mass a day. So to tell you again, to share how my alcoholism, my alcoholic nature, my rebelliousness, once I discovered that authenticity of wine at Mass, I used to say one, two, three, four, five Masses a day because of the elixir, because of the magic, because, as the big book says so beautifully, succinctly, clearly, because of the power. Because I discovered that first time that I wanted to have an authentic Mass, I wanted to just be just like, exactly like the priest at the church. And I went through the whole Mass muttering all the things, and just calmly went up to communion time. I picked up a nickel wafer and I made a very solemn sign of the cross. And I communed and I prayed. And I picked up the cocktail glass with the wine and I made a solemn sign of the cross. And I communed and I prayed. Oh, I have never forgotten that moment. It's as vivid right now as it was then. And I would still be drinking if I hadn't found something better, with more power, a greater power, through 12 steps. Because, I'm telling you, when that wine went down and I prayed for a little while and the alcohol hit my body temperature, it exploded in all directions. I could feel my toenails go boom. It was beautiful. And I don't know now how I knew, but there was an instinctual thing, an instinctual realization that when I swallowed that wine and I got my system got to the alcohol, because that's what we want, isn't it? The alcohol, not the beer, not the wine, not the booze, nothing else. Alcohol, alcohol. When my system got it and it went in all directions, I knew I had my salvation. I knew now I had my life in control. I knew now that I was going to be the master of the ship, the master of my own destiny. I had power. Alcohol, the big book says, this is so terse, so compact, so synthesized. Alcohol is cunning, cunning. Oh, alcohol is baffling. And alcohol is full of power. And those who drink it, those who consume it, become cunning, become baffling, and become powerful. And let me tell you, in the fourth grade, I was full of power. I had yet to learn how to be cunning and baffling, but I was going to learn. The alcohol was going to teach me. Like many, many of an incipient alcoholic, a beginning alcoholic, I was very shy. Not a whole lot of self-confidence. I can remember, I lived in pretty much of a suburban area that was quite countrified. There were only a few kids in the whole neighborhood. And any sports we had were all pickup games. Nothing as highly organized as we have today. Just go down to the field down the road, get a few kids, and take a bat, choose up sides. And I can remember so distinctly going down to those games and hearing the two men who were choosing sides say, "I'll take John, I'll take Sam, I'll take Pete, I'll take Bob, I'll take Tom, I'll take Dick, I'll take Harry," and on and on. And suddenly, in the middle of this enormous arena, so I felt, and in the marvelous stage whisper the kids have, to hear behind you, "Ooh," and boy, this was cutting. "Ooh, this cut me down in self-esteem." To hear one guy tell the other guy, "No, you take him. I had him the last time." And no, they were talking about you. So they were tolerated. They tolerated me in their games. They just tolerated me. And I don't blame them. Because like anything else, you know, low self-esteem, lack of confidence increases. It kind of almost makes you a ready-made failure. And I didn't catch the balls. It's true, I couldn't catch them. I didn't believe I could, so I couldn't, and I didn't. And I got up to bat, and I didn't believe I could hit it, and I didn't. In fact, I only thought there was one word in baseball: out. But not that I ever became any Joe DiMaggio or anything. But after that first summer tryst with alcohol, I was chosen, if not first, at least third or fourth to play. And do you know what? I began catching balls. Do you know what? I began connecting once in a while. Magic. You see, it did it. What was the cause of success? The power, the power. And that did nothing but increase from the fourth grade all the way through to the eighth grade, all the way through high school. I have to tell you that I was the most popular kid in Cleveland, Ohio. My mother owned three restaurants, all of which had bars. I was invited to every party in the city of Cleveland, Ohio. Because the cunningness had started. I had access to three bar room storerooms in three different restaurants. And I stole so many bottles from each one of the three bars until I had a case of 12. And then I went to the party. And boy, don't you, those kids were just waiting. "When's Coke coming? When's Coke coming?" Always welcomed. But I stole high school from my own mother. She suddenly became aware that there were some things missing besides money from the till. So she narrowed it down to two bartenders. And I'm going to give you a lot of fifth step material tonight. Let me tell you, I helped her. She thought it was two of the bartenders that were taking the whiskey, the booze, and were slipping a few bills out of the till, and I confirmed her. And as a result of that, Those two bartenders were fired, and they were both married men, and they had families. And I never felt any guilt or any remorse about that until just a few years ago. Because that's a marvelous thing that the alcohol did to me. It deadened conscience. It deadened my gut. It deadened that place, that only place where I can find some kind of a contact with a greater power, with great reality. It deadened it. So, a lot of other things happen. But how do you keep on drinking? How do you keep on drinking in this genesis of an alcoholic, me? How do you keep on drinking? Well, especially when, even somehow deep, far back in your mind, you know it's not the right thing to do. There's all kinds of little proddings that come at you. Then you've got to find something to hold on to. You've got to find something to justify the drinking. And I never realized how I had found this until, in reading the big book, I came across this sentence. Resentment is the number one offender. Do you want to drink or shoot or pop or snort? Do you want to do that? Then wake up a resentment. Wake it up. And you'll do it. Because it is so painful. It is so utterly painful. And do you know what? The spirit of the human being cannot endure pain. Indeed, the spirit of the human being will not endure pain. People can endure physical pain to a degree that is phenomenal. But when the pain hits the spirit, they will not endure it. Spiritual pain demands relief. And you will get it one way or another. You will find something. I don't know how you spell relief. Some people I know spelled S-E-X. Well, I thought it was kind of funny. Especially when it's not one of my outlets. I just spelled relief D-O-O-Z-E. And I got the resentment I needed. Because when I was a child, I used to go to the attic quite a bit and rummage through boxes on rainy days. And I came across a whole series of documents. Said something about a divorce. Said something about an adoption. And there was a baptismal certificate in there. And there was a birth certificate in there. And there were a couple strange names. I couldn't figure it out. But on another rainy day when I was a little older, I went back up again, and I sat down, and I figured the whole thing out. My mother conceived me when she was 14 years old. And she delivered me when she was 15. Out of wedlock. She was the daughter, Irish daughter, of Irish parents who came right from Ireland and who had one standard response to everything. The church says, Father says. And so when my mother conceived me out of wedlock and delivered me, my grandmother says, the church says you're going to hell, honey. On the baptismal certificate reads, James Edward, son of Mary Lucille Collins, and in Latin, isn't the church gracious? In Latin, the phrase, Pater ignotus. Translated, Father unknown. Which is not really true. But since they weren't married when I was delivered, the Father's unknown. So in the eyes of the church, I am a bastard. And I gotta tell you, I still am. But I'm a happy one. As it happened, my mother married my natural father about 3 months after I was delivered in order to legitimize me as far as the state went. But, heavens to Betsy, can you imagine? As far as the poor Irish grandmother went, she's got her in hell. All she can do is push her down deeper. Because when she married my natural father, my mother, who was a pure ghetto Irish, married my natural father, can you imagine, who was a fallen away Orthodox Jew. Now, famous Irish here, they'll know what that means for an Irish person. I still think there's some truth in the thing that that an Irishman is a Jew turned inside out. But... at any rate, for the Irish grandmother, that was too much. A little farther, a little deeper down. They were married 1 month, probably divorced the next month. Thank heaven. Because my grandmother used to delight in telling me about my natural father that when one of my aunts would wheel me down the street, that, not this did happen often, but a couple times happened, that my natural father went by, stopped, he knew who the woman was, it was my mother's sister, he looked down, and that's myself lying in the crib, or the perambulator buggy. And my grandmother said he would look at me and spit on me. This helps self-esteem. Plus, I learned very early age never to take off my shoes and stockings if my grandmother was around. As it happens, on my right foot, I have two toes that are webbed. They're together all the way up. And every time I would take off my shoes and my grandmother would spy my toes, she would say to me, "Oh, the mark of the devil's on you." Because the belief among the Irish was the devil had cloven feet, webbed feet. So the mark of the devil is on me. I remember that distinctly, clearly. The mark of the devil is on me. I don't need to tell you that in my later years of drinking, I utilized that. So then when I was about 3 years old, my mother remarried, which occurred to my grandmother, you couldn't do it. The church says you can't remarry. The church says you can't have babies outside of wedlock. The church says you can't get married by a JP. The church says you cannot marry an Orthodox Jew. The church says you cannot get a divorce. The church says you cannot remarry. So my mother remarried. So if you can imagine how deep in hell the poor thing is. We married a man whose name I bear. And of which I am very proud. I never really thank that man enough for the love and attention he gave to me, even though I was not his child. So I had the grist, you see, for the gin mill. I had the resentment because in the Catholic Church, with all this against her, my mother was excommunicated. We used to go to church. She saw to it. We all went to church every Sunday. But she would set me down in the front and everything. And she would then go to the back of the church and behind a pillar stand there through the entire service. Do you know why? I knew why. She wasn't good enough to sit with you good people. She was slime. She was dirt. You were too good. And that woman's church meant everything to her. Everything. Her Catholic faith meant everything to her. When it came time for her to die, she died an alcoholic. The last three years of her life. Within about a year and a half, she was absolutely full of cirrhosis. I mean, she drank to die. It was a real death wish fulfilled. But she couldn't stand the pain anymore. Couldn't stand the pain. The spiritual pain. And I knew that she wanted to be reconciled to her church. And I called a priest friend. And he looked at the whole thing. And he said, well, the only way she can do this, basically, to have her 98 cents worth of chemicals, because that's all we're worth, even on an inflated market. 98 cents worth of chemicals is all I've got. To have those 98 cents worth of chemicals wheeled into a church and wheeled back out again. I would never have done it had I known what she had to do. Because he came in with a document and he made her dying, gasping, practically death rattling, repeat after her that she renounced her husband, my stepfather. It was blood curdling. And she had to do that in order to have to be buried. It wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth it now, today. It wasn't worth it. My grandmother would not even go to her funeral because she said the devil's in the church. They can't bury her from the church. She would not accept that. She wouldn't go to the wake. I know where she was coming from when I loved her. She was a great woman. I know where she was coming from. Black. And my grandmother had her in hell, and that's why she couldn't be buried from the church. But the Irish have a saying. They say that the mother of a priest will wear a crown in heaven. So I says to myself, says I, you got her in hell, Grandma? I'm getting her out. And I did. I became a priest. That's my motivation. The motivation to become a priest. Here's resentment. Become what it all must become. All resentment eventually has to lead to revenge. And so I'm getting her out of hell. And let me tell you, my motivation for becoming a priest 35 years ago, May 17th, my motivation was to destroy the church from within. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful. I am going to destroy the church. Let me tell you and confide in you too, I did not want to be a priest. I wanted to be a bishop.
power.
And I played a lovely game all the way through the seminary. I shone, I excelled, I outstarred, to the point that a number of men on the faculty of the seminary from which I graduated, the theology house, came and told me face to face, "We're pretty sure, James, you're going to be the bishop's secretary." And I very modestly said, "Oh, no, no, no." Inside I'm saying, "Secretary Baloney, bishop." Well, as it happened, dear friend, I did not become the bishop's secretary. Worse, or better, depending upon whether you have an alcoholic point of view. I was appointed spiritual director of the seminary. And I did not know until I got that job the power, the cunningness, and the bafflingness that I was capable of. Because over 11 years, I don't think my God ever allowed this to happen. My faith is too much for this one. But I must, this is a fifth step, and every time I give an open talk, I have to say this, because I have no other way of making amendments for this. Over those 11 years, as spiritual director, every man in that seminary had to come and visit me at least twice during the year. And it was usually more than that. And my motivation in talking to them was very insidiously, subtly, but definitely. To destroy their vocation. I don't think my God would ever allow that. But that's beside the point, because that was my motivation. That was my intention. And I rejoiced every time a young man left the seminary. Inside. In this terrible house of pain. Inside. You know, revenge, resentment become revenge is like a boomerang. You throw it out to hit somebody, hit the church. And it does. But it grazes the church a little bit, and then it begins its backward movement. Back to you. When you are living with that much pain, again, I say, you have to have relief. So the drinking increased, and my behavior became increasingly worse. But I had without any guilt. I delighted in it. In fact, one time the bishop called me in. One time he called me in, sat me down in front of him, and he was sitting at the table like this, you know. And finally he looked up, and I was sitting there. I have never seen a human being that looked exactly like a beagle hound. But that poor man did. He looked up at me, and I'm telling you, his face was just, oh. He looked up at me, and he said, "Father James," he said, "do you know that I am afraid to open the morning paper? Front page news. All kinds of bizarre behavior. But a lot of it deliberate. And an honest fourth and fifth was deliberate. A lot of it was deliberate. And I took delight in a lot of it. Because I was still tearing down the church. My poor bishop was one of my greatest enablers, you know. You always have to have enablers. If you don't have them, you make them. My greatest enablers were my bishop, two judges, four lawyers, and about maybe 7 or 8 cops. But my poor bishop was in denial that I had a problem. He didn't want to say that the priest was a drunk. The priest was an alcoholic. There's something wrong up here. But, however, I did go to 20 treatment centers, 15 of which I graduated from, summa cum laude, because 3 of them I drank through and they never caught me. And one of those is right down in Chippewa Falls. L.E. Phillips, if I remember right. And another one is over in Rochester, Minnesota. 3 martinis a day. And they never caught me. You tell me that alcohol is not cunning and baffling? Fifteen, graduated from. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that I have gone through 15 fourth steps and fifth steps? I should really say, well, the 15th was a good one. The 15th was a good one. 14th. Can you imagine what the 14th one was like when you had 13 times to practice? I am telling you that poor person that sat across from me, I could see his hair just going, whoa, because there was not one word of truth in the whole thing. It became an art. Until the 15th, and indeed since then, the 5th steps I've done. 5 treatment centers I walked out of. And 5 insane asylums. And I'm just going to tell you about one. Each one is a story all in itself. But I'm going to tell you about one. Bishop sent me to St. Louis. And I went down in the plane, got off the plane, got a cab, and I said, I want to go to St. Vincent's. One. I said, what do you mean, which one? He said, what, do you want to go to the hospital or the nut house? So I said, the one on Rock Road. He says, the nut house. I'm sharing this because this is part, in a strange way, this is part of my recovery. I'm going too long. When I got there, the next day, the psychiatrist came in, and we talked for a while, and then he said, well, Reverend, he said, you come at a very bad time. You're kidding. He said, I'm leaving on vacation tomorrow, and I'm going to be gone for 6 weeks. So he said, would you like to have another doctor? I said, no, I see what I got, I'll go with what I got. So he left. Whether he did it intentionally or not, I don't know, but it was providential. It was providential. It was part of my greater power working in my life. He left no orders for me. That meant that I could not leave the room without an orderly. I hope there are no orderlies here because I still resent orderlies. You have me down in your room, you know, and looking down, they're down there, and one foot's got to be in the room. And you have to go like mad, and you're going, oh. And they are standing way down there, and they see you. I know they see you. They take 1 hour to get the pack of cigarettes out, 1 hour to get the cigarette out, 1 hour to find their lighter, 1 hour to light it. And then they take one of this horrible, obscene drag. And they turn down towards your room, and they go, and that smoke comes all the way down. I really went wild. Because when they finally take you to the John, you know, you sit here on the throne, and what do you think? They sit there. Your only defense is constipation.
But anyway, I got so angry. And there were so many unresolved things in my whole lifetime looming around inside of me. And I'm not getting the relief I need. I don't have the relief that I need from booze. And I'm not getting any pills because there's no order. And I'm going back and forth in this room, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There's only a bed there with a mattress on it and one chair. I picked up the mattress, threw it outside, picked up the chair, smashed it through the bars at the window, picked up the bed itself and zoomed it up against the door and back again, smashing, smashing. Well, in a very short time, where do you think I was? Sitting in the middle of an empty room. In white, summer white clothing. But I noticed, you see, when I was doing that pacing back and forth, it seemed to me like the room was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You know why? Because everything was inside of me. Everything was clunked inside. Everything was churning, churning, churning inside of me. And all kinds of anger and the resentment. And just got tighter, tighter, and the ceiling started coming down. The window with bars on it, had a number of bars, it suddenly turned up into whatever it was, five bars. It became one great big black mass. That's all I could see was one black mass. And I'm in this little tiny room with this black mass. So I have to rebel. And they put me in that white. I had to sit in the middle of the room. And I had to start thinking, 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 thinking. And I did. And I came to the conclusion. I said, Jamesy, old boy, you are completely bananas. You are bonkers. You think you're not. You think everything is happening on the outside like this, but it's not. That's only going on in your head. Outside, you're a raving maniac, running up and down, screaming, and doing all kinds of horrible things. So you're crazy. And I dealt with that and dealt with that and dealt with that. And I began somehow to do a fourth step on that and a fifth step on that. And I came to the conclusion, I came in a roundabout way, I came to a third step. I made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of that insane asylum. And it worked. It worked. Once I had made that decision that I was powerless, you see, and I have no more physical control over my life, people got to take me to the toilet, they got to watch me, they got to watch me shave, everything. I have lost manageability. So I am bonkers. And once I surrendered to that, and that's the key, isn't it? The surrender. What is step one? It's just a great big head step. That's all it is. It's a great big head step. It won't work with just a head step. A head step's got to become a little bit, it's got to go into a heart step, and that to me is step two. To believe that some power greater than myself can do something about this. And then you go from the head to the heart to the gut. And that's step three. There's no way out. Cokie, old boy, you are crazy. Do you know what happened? They took off the white suit. They brought back in the bed. They brought back in the mattress and the pillow and the sheets and the blankets. They brought back in the chair, and they brought back in a desk. And do you know what they gave me? A pencil. Now, that's an act of trust with violent people. That's an act of trust. Somebody trusted me with a pencil. I was very happy. The room got bigger. I felt like it was a great big mammoth room. I felt free. Nobody found me. I looked out the window. I didn't see any bars anymore. There was a great big tree down here. And do you know what? During those 6 weeks, do you know what I watched happen? I watched two blue jays mate. And it was beautiful. I had never seen or watched anything like that in my whole life. I watched them raise their family. It was beautiful. Something I had missed, among many other things. 6 weeks later, the doctor came back. Came in and sat and talked. He took a lot of tests for a whole week, all kinds of tests. Bing, 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 bing. You know, what do you see here? What do you put that black at the moon? So after a week, he came in with a great big sheaf of papers, and I thought, oh boy, I got something that's really unusual. He sat down, and he said to me, he said, Reverend, look through all your tests. And he said, Reverend, I'm going to release you tomorrow.
I said, you can't. You can't put me out in the streets. I'm not safe. You can't do this. I'm crazy. I'm a maniac.
And the psychiatrist sat there and said, oh, no, Reverend. No, Reverend. He said, you are not crazy. Reverend, you are an alcoholic. I'm telling you, you never saw such a livid blue streak come out of anybody's mouth as came out of my mouth at that man. The things, I can't repeat them, the things that I called him. But I finally said, and I know now, doctor, why you work in a place like this. So he released me, and I couldn't go back to my bishop. He says, don't come back for 10 years. Give the people a chance to forget. So I'm stuck down in St. Louis. So now I got to prove I'm not an alcoholic. There's another lovely way to prove it. Become a workaholic. So in a very short time, I was teaching in a high school in St. Louis, teaching Latin. I was teaching English in a grammar school, and I was principal of that grammar school. I was teaching in Webster College. I was teaching in Amerillac Sisters College. I was teaching in Kenrick Seminary. And I was giving talks every single week at a cloistered nun's convent, besides helping out in a parish, doing all the parish work and all kinds of other things, teaching the parish too. See, I never said no. Because I asked you, would you, if you had children in a grade school, would you hire an alcoholic to be the principal? No way. They hired me. Therefore, I'm not. That continued and continued, and I finally went back to my diocese after 11 years, and it was like returning to the scene of the crime. Things got worse than ever. I finally went to the bishop, and I said, I have a good friend in Cleveland, Ohio. He's the county commissioner. I went to school with him. I think, I'm pretty sure I've talked to him. He'll give me a job. And maybe that's what I need, Bishop. I said, maybe I need to go away and get my head together, which was a lie. I just wanted to drink and not have anybody watching me. But when I said to the bishop, I said, Bishop, if I could go there and get my head together, maybe my act straightened up, I said, if you would give me a leave of absence. You got it! Even to think about that, it was just instantaneous. You got it. So I left, dear friends. I left and went back to Cleveland, Ohio. I went through 15 jobs in 15 months. Fired from every single one of them. The last job, can you imagine, was a night clerk in a shack-up motel. And they fired me for lack of performance. We know what they meant, though, don't we? I finally ended up on welfare. Cunning, baffling. I found two dead bodies on West 25th Street in Cleveland, Ohio, which is Skid Row, Cleveland, Ohio, in the alley. I stripped them all, everything they had, and I was able to fake, and I collected their welfare checks for 4 months, my own plus two, till I got caught up with, at which time I had to go into the woodwork. And so I went down underneath the high-level bridge, which spans the east side to the west side over the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio. And way back, the bridge is all closed. The streetcars used to go down underneath it. But way back, it's all marble, and
whatnot, warm. Went back there. Here is now the boomerang of resentment become revenge flying all the way back. Did it hit the church? No. Here I am, underneath the high-level bridge, covered over with newspapers, sucking on a brown bag, and the Catholic Church is going on its merry way, unscathed by everything I did. So who is suffering? And that's where I would have stayed. Because there was one word, dear friends, since I started in the fourth grade, it left my vocabulary. It never returned until one day, I can't remember because I was in a blackout, but the one word that is the magic door opener. I can't remember it, but a friend who I saw later said I said it over and over and over and over again. It is the one word, whether you're an alcoholic, an addict, or anything else, it is the one word where all spirituality begins. There is no spirituality without this word. It is the most beautiful word, spiritual word, to incorporate into your vocabulary and try to say it. I know you are here because you are saying it. You would not be here. You would not be sitting here this long if you were not saying this beautiful word. But sometimes you need to say it. Like I need to say it every time I go to a meeting, every time I call up my sponsors, every time I pick up the big book, every time I try to meditate on the 12 steps. And the one word that got me out from underneath the high-level bridge, underneath the newspapers, I'm sucking on a brown bag. Help! Isn't that a beautiful word? Help! Alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful. What's the next sentence? Without help, it's too much. And I yelled help, and I knew five priests in Cleveland, Ohio that were friends of mine. I went to school with them. They're all recovering alcoholics. One of them I love. He's still alive. Three of them I have great admiration for, and one of them I have hated since I knew him in first grade. And who do you think I called for? And he picked me up, and he brought me from Cleveland, Ohio to Detroit to Father Vaughn Quinn's Sacred Heart, because he'd been to treatment with him. He got me in as a freebie there at Sacred Heart, and I was there. I just want to try to close up. I was put into a room, this long, narrow room. It's about five beds in it. And I came to in that room. My memory started working again. I didn't know where I was. And I asked the guy, he said, Sacred Heart. I tried to think St. John's and this and this and this. I said, this and, you know, there's no Sacred Heart in Cleveland, Ohio. I said, you know, what's the name of this suburb? The guy said, suburb? It's Detroit, Michigan. And I found out who brought me there. I had to see the papers. I had to see the man's name. He signed me in. Because I could not believe that I would have asked for that man to do anything for me. But there was his name. So I sat on that bed in that narrow room. And I felt in the Catholic Church, when you bring the casket in, they put a pall down over it. I felt like a pall coming. I was in a casket. It's coming down, 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 bang, boom. And I just said, for the first time in my life, really, 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 not religion, spirituality, though, I said, God, it's over. It's all over. And I just felt so relieved. And when I could walk a little bit, I went down a hallway. A few days later, I'm walking down, and here comes a man all dressed in black, that little white thing there. I didn't know who he was, gray hair, with Father Quinn. Saw him coming towards me. I didn't know he knew me. He came up to me. He put his arm around me, and he said to me, "Welcome home." Now that arm of Father Quinn, has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger until here I stand in Marinette, Wisconsin, still being embraced by an arm of people who say to me, by your attention to me, welcome home. Thank you.